the headlines. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the enemy has launched a multi-front invasion against the country, urging authorities to respond accordingly. Iran's top security official slams the U.S. administration's continued maximum pressure campaign amid the Vienna talks on removing anti-Tehran sanctions. And Beijing condemns the latest planned U.S. arms sales to Taiwan, saying that it seriously undermines China's security and sovereignty.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, says that the enemy has launched a multi-front invasion against Iran, from politics and economy to security, media, and diplomacy. Ayatollah Khamenei said, facing such a vast invasion, Iran cannot always maintain a defensive strategy, and officials need to deliver a multi-pronged security, economic, and media response. He also noted that Western powers claim to advocate freedom of expression, but resort to media dictatorship to censor social media posts about Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's anti-terror commander whom the U.S. assassinated in a drone strike. The leader said Western powers would place a media ban on every word or image that runs counter to their policies, but use the same platforms to unleash destructive offensives against Iran and the Islamic Republic. He also said the U.S. is taking a blow from where it least expected, adding the previous and current U.S. presidents have joined hands to further disgrace Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with a group of commanders and staff members of Iran's Air Force. Iran's top security official, meanwhile, is urging the U.S. to drop its maximum pressure campaign just as the eighth round of negotiations on the revival of Iran's deal is set to resume in Vienna. Ali Shamkhani says the current U.S. administration has been trying to achieve, with empty promises, the goals that former President Donald Trump failed to achieve through bullying. The official believes, with Washington harboring illusions, the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 accord will not be fruitful. Iran and the P4 plus 1 group are set to recommence discussions in the Austrian capital today. Iran's foreign minister is hoping that a final deal will be sealed in the coming days. Hossein Amir Abdollahian has urged the West to be realistic and to take effective steps towards removing the sanctions. And just as the parties involved in the Vienna negotiations are preparing to take up the talks where they left off, bipartisan divisions continue to prevail in the U.S., with dozens of Republican senators warning President Joe Biden that they might block any new nuclear agreements with Iran. In a letter to Biden, a group of 33 lawmakers have said that they would thwart the implementation of any new accord if his government does not allow Congress to review and to vote on his terms. The group of legislators is being led by Senator Ted Cruz, a longtime opponent of the Iran deal. They have threatened to use the full range of options and leverage available to ensure that the Biden administration would adhere to U.S. laws before reaching any new deal with Iran. Journalist and political commentator Abbas Aslani says that U.S. officials remain split over what decisions to make on dealing with Iran, while Tehran has completely clear positions on issues like the lifting of sanctions.
The Iranian team has achieved a conclusion and now has a clear agenda on those four issues of lifting of the sanctions, verification, guarantees, as well as the nuclear issue. They know what to do, and I was hearing from a source close to the Iranian negotiating team that the Iranian team has made its decision. They know what to do now. But they were concerned that the United States has not made a political decision yet. Because what we are hearing from the United States is not a, let's say, united voice. You see what is happening in the Congress, what is happening between, even among the Democrats themselves. U.S. Chief Negotiator was expected to attend a hearing session in Congress on Wednesday. If that happens, that could be one day after the talks are resumed in Vienna.
I'm going to go back to our story on statements made by Iran's leader. Sayyid Hosseini is a scholar and political commentator who joins us. Sayyid Hosseini, welcome. Iran's leader has said that there is a multi-pronged invasion against Iran, or multi-front, as he said, from politics, economy, to security, media, and diplomacy, and that Iran can't always maintain a defensive posture. Can you break down what Iran's leader is saying there?
Well, what particularly the Supreme Leader wants is to avoid all of the negative history that America had in dealing with this agreement. We are actually dealing with a country which does not have no respect to any international law, having a president who, unilaterally comes and disagree with the with not only this agreement but a lot of other international agreements which Trump didn't respect and came out of this international agreement. Well, having all of this history in mind, Iran has got all rights to consider the measurements by all means to actually save the future of this agreement and also the possible neglection of the United States again after signature this time. So that's why the Supreme Leader has actually introduced measures and has expressed his precautions and give advices to the team and both sides what to do to protect the Iranian rights. I think that's the one.
One of the things that I'm interested to find out from you as to why the Western media has picked up on is what Iran's leader has said regarding Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that both have damaged the reputation of the U.S., and that's what they picked up on. Why is that important to the West? I mean, is that the case, and what do you think about what Iran's leader has said on that?
Well, what happened, I mean, that is not only what Supreme Leader says, that's what the whole world talks about, that what Trump did is actually brought the standard of America down to a country which does not have no respect to any international laws. The history of the United States shows that particularly when it comes to the Middle East issues, particularly when it comes to Iran, and especially when it comes to Israel, they don't have no any respect to any international laws. Just imagine all resolutions of United Nations and Security Council against Israel has been vetoed with no exception in the last 70 years. Regardless of how many people, how many countries voted in those resolutions and how many people in the world were supporting the notion, but still they have gone against all international laws and agreements, and they have actually vetoed something which the whole world wants. So all of the history that United States has created a big damage to the name of the United States as a nation and as a state which you can't trust. When they say something, they may anytime go against their words, and this reputation which has been created by United States through the actions of their leaders has brought to the attention of Iran that with this nation you must be very careful. When they talk, they won't act. When they sign, they don't respect. So take the necessary measurements this time. Actually, when they sign, they should respect, and should be some measurements for them to pay for the price if they come out.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That is Sayed Hosseini, scholar and political commentator. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
The Islamic Revolution in 1979 replaced Iran's monarchy with an Islamic establishment that has been governing the country since then. Pacific correspondent Danjuma Abdullahi reports on the impact of the revolution in Nigeria.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale, and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and all the like, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
China issues a stern warning to the United States over its plans to provide up to $100 million worth of arms and military services to Taiwan. The foreign ministry says the arms sales would seriously undermine China's security and sovereignty. The ministry says that Beijing will take robust measures to protect its security interests. Taiwan, however, has welcomed the U.S. move, saying that the deal will take effect in March. Washington has increased its military support to Taipei over the past years amid rising tensions with Beijing. China considers Taiwan as an inseparable part of its territory and has warned Washington that it could trigger war by further pushing the island territory to seek independence. Russia and China denounced the unilateral sanctions imposed by countries without the backing of the UN Security Council. The Russian Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Dmitry Polyansky, says the unilateral sanctions interfere with the sovereignty of nations and hurts peace efforts. Meanwhile, the Chinese ambassador to the UN has described coercive unilateral sanctions as a major source of concern. Zhang Jun says that countries that initiate sanctions become addicted to them and they need to stop immediately. He also says sanctions that do not receive the support of the Security Council should not be applied extensively. According to the Chinese diplomat, UN sanctions against North Korea have serious humanitarian consequences. Currently, 14 countries are under UN sanctions. The Russian president says his country's military buildup is conducted on its own soil, dismissing as baseless allegations that Russia is posing a threat to Ukraine. Vladimir Putin made the remarks at a joint press conference with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron in Moscow. Putin warned that European countries will be drawn into a military conflict with Russia in case NATO admits Ukraine as a member. He expressed hope that the standoff over Ukraine will be settled through dialogue, referring to concerns that Moscow expects the West to respond to. During the conference, the French President Emmanuel Macron talked about the security guarantees that he has proposed to Putin.
Bâtir ensemble.
While respecting our fundamentals, building together concrete security guarantees for the member states of the European Union, for the states of the region, Ukraine, Georgia, Belarus, and for Russia, that is exactly the ambition we must pursue.
Macron expressed hope that diplomatic efforts could resolve the crisis. Prior to the two presidents' meeting, Moscow did not set an optimistic tone. It said the meeting was unlikely to pave the way for, quote, a decisive breakthrough, as the situation is too complex. Tensions over Ukraine have escalated in recent weeks. Moscow wants NATO to stop its eastward expansion in Europe and to bar Ukraine from joining the military alliance. After a bumpy week of mass resignations at his office and growing calls for his resignation, the British Prime Minister is making changes to the makeup of the staff at his Downing Street residence, hoping to change his own Conservative Party members' mind about an imminent no-confidence vote. From London, Saeed Puriza reports on the state of play in the so-called Partygate scandal.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's been driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
This is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as Prime Minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Saipur is up, London.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.org. www.ipm.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Is the UK's ambulance service in crisis? Recent news reports have revealed there are now too few crews to keep up with demand and the close to million calls they get every month. Despite limited resources, the ambulance crews are doing their best, but they know there is little prospect of a reduction in the massive pressures they have to endure every day.
Dealing with the increased number of calls caused by COVID has made the problems worse. However, the underlying issues are related to a rise in general demand for ambulance services and a fall in those currently employed to deliver it. Thousands of paramedics have left the ambulance service, leading to a shortfall that those who remain must try and cope with. The impact is clear and concerning. The service struggles to cope with demand, and as a result, ambulance service crews are regularly missing the time targets set for them. This in turn is increasing the level of stress on those who remain in the ambulance service. Indeed, stress-related illness amongst paramedics has gone up, with reported cases in the service increasing by 71% during the coronavirus pandemic.
How would it feel to wait for hours for an ambulance to arrive? And are the public concerned about a potentially growing shortage of ambulance crews for the winter ahead? Simple questions with important answers. Now let's start with this. Over the last 2 years, thousands of paramedics have left the service. How does the public feel about that? We put it to them outside this major hospital in London. Here's what they told us.
I feel that it takes a toll and effect on people because people are needing help. They've got no source of transport, no support, nothing to get to a hospital, you know. And some people live by themselves or are single parents, whatever. They've got no one to help them there.
They're understaffed and they should be properly funded, and there should be the money's there, so there should be the right funding for the right sectors. And if the money's there, then where's this money going? It's not to the right places.
Well, I think the government would need to do something about that because there are a lot of people that do need healthcare services. And I think they need to recruit more drivers.
I think that's bad because like ambulances are very important, and like if it takes long, it can affect someone's chance of surviving. So that's not a good thing.
It made me feel quite upset. So I think that we need those people, that those are the most vital people in life, basically, in every country. So, yeah, like we definitely need to get those numbers back so people can fill in those positions.
Well, I think I can understand it. I'm surprised that they've been able to cope as well as they seem to have, you know, over the past 18 months. It seems to be just relentless and quite thankless, too. You know, you hear about aggression towards ambulance drivers and that, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's probably it is sad, but I guess it's all the pressure that's on them, you know, dealing with social issues as well as the...
Well, concerned, for sure, because of safety. If we need service, what do we do? How do we go about it and get treated, you know, and so on, so yeah. But also, I'm a bit more concerned about the level of violence towards them, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard good things. I don't really know much about it. It seems pretty easy to get services. I know getting vaccinated was kind of difficult for some of my friends, which was, like, it was a priority for them to get vaccinated. So I think that might have been difficult. But yeah, I guess other than that, I've been able to access all the services I need. So, and as someone who's not actually...
A bit concerning, to be honest. I've only had one personal experience where I've had to call an ambulance in the UK, and I did find that the wait time was already quite long. So I think if there's any further reductions, it's just going to get worse and worse, and people are going to be waiting longer and longer. It's hard enough, as is, I think, with London, especially because of the traffic. It's hard to get ambulance to places they need to be with enough of them on the road, let alone if they remove some of them. So
it's scary because, like, we need the NHS. Like, we need... A lot of people can't afford privatised healthcare, so, like, having fewer ambulances means, like, probably more deaths, more, like, things that could have been prevented if we did have the right amount of funding and for the NHS and the ambulance.
The fact that there are fewer ambulance staff, I mean, I haven't ever needed any ambulance resource, but my first instinct is that it sounds like it's something that's critical.
Well, I used to be a care worker myself, so... That wasn't for the NHS, though. I have worked for the NHS since. But the main issue is really low rates of play, long hours, not very much encouragement, and a climate that whatever you do, it's going to be wrong.
I need to see the data to say if it's right or not, because I'm not entirely sure. But I do know that the queue is... The waiting time is longer to just get to the GP, that's for sure. At the same time, you know, if we want to have more staff, then we need to allocate more resources to that. And then, well, the funding obviously will have to change, so we need to cut it from somewhere else or collect more in taxes. So that's, you know.
Why can't the NHS retain enough staff to run the ambulance service? Here's the public's opinion.
Many, many things, many reasons come to mind. You know, pay, level of working conditions, level of pay, treatment by others, the attacks on people. The list goes on.
I'd say it would be a combination of things, like probably to do with pay, maybe something to do with Brexit as well, and probably just a whole different range of things.
I think probably burnout. You know, I think the best of times, it's quite a difficult job to. You know, it's not like going to your job and then just going home again. I think, you know, they're in there for long hours and they see a lot of difficult situations. And it's probably very hard for them to switch off. So if they're being overstretched, I imagine mentally it would be very difficult to cope. Apart from any of the other, you know, aggressions that they might face during the job, you know, which would discourage them.
I guess because it's like an extremely under strain... situation, and people aren't probably don't feel especially valued.
I mean, I've been in the in Canadian system since I was born, so I've never had any health issues either, so I can't really speak to that. But I think it's so far it's been quicker to get tests and prescriptions that I need here than it has been at home. That's something, I guess, yeah.
I think especially in the past year with coronavirus, they've been under a lot of stress. It's been very difficult for a lot of those staff. It might be that some of them can't take the pressure of it anymore and they're just not getting the same treatment and respect that they should be getting. I'm probably looking for a different job.
I feel like it could be a danger, but I feel like it could be, like, easy sword as well. Because, like, obviously with corona... it was affected a lot, but I feel like we can bounce back from that. So I feel like it could get back to a good position.
I think it's the government. I feel like the funding for the NHS, including the ambulance and, like, everything like that, the government is cutting down on, and we need to, like, increase the budget and for the NHS.
I can only assume the recent 2 years where I think people have been working under such stress without recovery time, with a lot of anxiety, and I get the impression that there's not very much resource and there's not very much support for them.
There's a lot of competition for jobs out there, pay's not very good, but the NHS costs the government a great deal of money, and I would imagine the government is struggling to find enough money to pay for all that, so it's in the same problem as a lot of employers have, which is finding enough money to pay wages that will attract people and get them to stay. It's not an easy problem to solve.
I'm not sure if it's less and less in people wanting to work for there. I think the demand is just higher. I think there's more and more people who need it, and I think the supply just doesn't meet it of the work stuff, but maybe there is less of people working as well. But for sure, I think there's just more people like coming to the UK in general.
It's stress from probably overwork and the amount of work that's expected from them and you know, trying to keep a brave face for the people that they're dealing with. Yeah.
I think there's something secretly going on that the public don't know about. As we all know, government always hides a bit more than what we know. Obviously, they're not getting paid enough for the great work they do. But I can't say I know, but you can tell from an outside point of view that something is not going right.
Yeah, stress, underfunding, severe underfunding, cuts. And it's one thing when the NHS is not properly funded, and another when Boris and his mates can just get their pay rises. And then, so obviously, the money's there because you know it's there. You can see where the money's going, and it's not going in the right places. So I imagine that, yeah, if they don't feel appreciated, what was it, last year, people were on their doorsteps clapping for them. It's like, yeah, that's all well and good, but it's just gestures at the end of the day, and they should be properly paid, and maybe then they wouldn't be having to leave.
Possibly because everybody wants to be safe and stay alive for their families. It might have something to do with the wages that they're being paid. Maybe the government needs to think about increasing their wages, and you know, that might possibly retain the staff.
Yeah, probably stress and pay and everything as well. Maybe abroad they might get better money and things like that, possibly.
We're heading into winter, and ambulance professionals are warning that things will get worse.
Yeah, again, it's very concerning if that is the case, where there's more and more people leaving the profession and there's not enough people to actually backfill them. Yeah, it's naturally concerning to anybody, really, and I think whoever are the policy makers need to do something about it to address that issue and be a little bit more transparent about it.
Regarding to your question, I just think that NHS did a lot for our country or from all the citizens of this country and for everyone. They looking after everyone like we are their own family, and also they maybe they are fed up a little bit like everyone, because if they are working too much and their work is not appreciated, obviously they are fed like a bit tired, just keeping working hard and maintain our healthy and to protect us. So it's like they're doing a really hard job for us to keeping everybody safe. And I think like everyone, they before their duties and their job, they are human, exactly like us. So I think they are a bit tired at the moment because they was working too hard to keeping everybody safe.
I mean, it's a little bit concerning. I know that people who work paramedics and people who work in that field are extremely valuable, and I think it's really important to pay them what they deserve, make sure that they have good working conditions, and do whatever's necessary to make sure that those services are accessible and available to people.
It's going to take a toll, and it's going to get scary. As you know, we're in a pandemic, and the crime is getting worse. Even the police, not just the ambulance, the police, they don't answer for hours. Imagine you're calling the police asking for help, you're going to get stabbed or anything, and they don't answer. You're on a 1-hour hold, and then no one comes. Just like the ambulance, your life is gone within seconds.
Oh, it's terrible. It's really horrible because, yeah, I mean, we live in like quite a progressive country where we should have these services very available, and the fact that they're not shows you something about the current state of this country.
That would be really devastating to know that, you know, on the other line of the telephone, if you call 999, there's nobody to pick up the call. You know, we do need that support, and we do pay our taxes for these services, so they should be made available.
I think there needs to be better methods of getting the ambulances to where they need to be, whether it's certain response roads or things like that that allow emergency services to access routes that cars and general traffic might not be able to use, or something along those lines that just allows them to get where they need to be faster.
I just feel like totally just hurt, just like thinking that it didn't have to be like this, and just wishing that there would be someone there to come to the scene as soon as possible, because a lot of times I know many people that's been in a position where they had to wait loads of minutes for ambulance to come. So yeah, just it's like not everyone has a car to get to the ambulance as well. So it's kind of hard. You might have to find different ways of transportation, and with the stress of having to deal with whoever you're dealing with at the moment, that's kind of hard to do. So yeah.
Well, it's a very unpleasant thought. I mean, I actually needed to call an ambulance just 2 days ago, and I was incredibly lucky, I suppose, because there was somebody there within 25 minutes. And that's when things are sort of quite difficult at the moment. It would be nice to think that there'll be a way to sort of supplement the service that they're providing at the moment. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, my case wasn't particularly life-threatening, but... I imagine if you're lying there with a broken leg or something, I mean, that's going to be a very difficult situation for people to deal with.
It'd be awful, you know, to be in that position. But, you know, it's something that needs to be addressed along with all the other social care issues that are needs to be addressed by government, yeah.
It does, because it's putting family, loved ones at risk. When you are in need, nobody is coming.
Let's look at the facts, and the statistics tell a story of concern. Since 2018, the number of paramedics has fallen from 32,200 to 28,700. Largely because of this, emergency call-out waiting times are on average 9 minutes instead of the target 7 minutes. Less serious call-out times are 46 minutes versus the 18-minute target. And non-emergency waiting times can reach as much as 7.5 hours, with one patient held in an ambulance in the west of England for 11 hours and 46 minutes.
How would people here in London feel if they had to wait for up to 7.5 hours for an ambulance to arrive?
It's happened to me so many times, I don't call ambulance again. I just get a taxi.
I'd be really like upset if I had to wait that length of time for an ambulance. Like, I have had to wait long for, like, I've called an ambulance before and had to wait 4 hours, so, but that wasn't an emergency one, so.
That's inexcusable, really. And there was another case I heard about the other day, and it was even longer than that, and the person died as a result of it. I think it was a heart problem by the time they actually got to where they needed to get him. It was too late. So I think for a country that has the wealth of Britain, this shouldn't be happening. I think there must be a way around it. I mean, I lived in Germany for many years. I don't think in Germany this would be acceptable. It just, they would find a way to cope with whatever shortages that they have.
Be angry and, you know, yeah, and just worrying about your own health and, yeah, knowing that help is usually you associate the ambulance should be with you in 7 to 8 minutes, but are those days gone? That's, you know, yeah, be very angry, yeah.
I feel sad because I live by myself. I feel sad because you feel like no one cares about you, and you feel like the only people that would care about you, the ambulance, unfortunately, they can't be there.
Well, it's terrible, obviously. If you have an illness or a problem, if you're sick, you need to go to the hospital, then... yeah, it's not like in the States where you'd have to pay to go for the ambulance. You know, like I hear a lot of stories when they say if you're pregnant in the States, then you have to pay for the ambulance. So people would rather pay for an Uber. It's like imagine having to pay for a taxi to take you to the ambulance when to take you to hospital when the ambulance should be provided there because you pay all this tax money, and where's it going?
Really scared because like I said, some families and some people, some individuals are home alone, they have no families, you know, so they rely on the public health service to be there for them in times of emergencies, really.
What's the public's message to government about the growing emergency in the ambulance services?
I think from a government point of view, the NHS is complex because of its size. We often talk about the inefficiencies, but it's more than that. It seems many of them are underpaid. That has to be resolved. I think they need a lot of softer support. They need their own therapies and coaching to help them with the traumas that they've been through. And as a member of the public, I've no idea.
I think supporting them as a government, listening to their you know, complaints or comments about working conditions, hours that they work, support in terms of infrastructure that they need, and at least considering it before kind of going ahead with any sort of political agenda.
Well, I'd like them to say step up and, you know, just get with it. You know, look at what's happening out and don't sort of hide behind it. Don't be shy about it. You know, look at this, what's going on, and put some investment behind it.
Our message is to government is to basically come together and find different ways how you can promote the job for the ambulance drivers, and just basically use everything you have to try and make people want to come and work for the ambulance, and don't that respect them as well.
So look at their hours, look at the work that they do, the work that's expected of them, and, you know, offer them more flexible hours, more training, and more, yeah, just more help generally.
The job is very stressful, and it's well underpaid, so the government needs to pay people well and make sure that the working environment is safe. Also, the people need to relax about people who work in the NHS, because when they see something on social, they take it too seriously. The job is stressful, people need to de-stress, and people do things differently.
Well, I think they may find that people start becoming more active in their unhappiness with the situation. You know, I'm not sort of suggesting that people become more aggressive, but I think some kind of popular action is probably going to happen sooner or later, because people are being pressed in so many areas, and this is possibly going to be, you know, just the final straw for a lot of people.
Recruit more staffs, pay good wages, and hopefully the staff members would stay.
My message to the government is fix up. Start caring about people, because you really care about your money. That's it, you care about how your family is and everything like that, and your government, whatever. But how about the civilians? Because we make up the country, we make up the world. You know, they care about themselves, until one day it's going to fall back on them. You know, that's my message to the government, is fix up.
There is no doubt the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the underlying issues which the ambulance service has been dealing with. Continued decline in the number of paramedics available. It is also clear that the psychological effects on those who remain continue to cause increasing concern. There have even been reports of suicide in the service.
The NHS is often described as a crowning achievement of the British state. For decades, it has served the public all year round. But with falling numbers of paramedics and almost a million calls a month, demand simply exceeds supply. As we head towards a potentially troubling winter rise in those calls, the evidence suggests that the UK Emergency Ambulance Service is on the verge of declaring an emergency of its own.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Whoa.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi as-salam. We were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen and how he wanted to establish a system that is fair for everybody, a system where the poor are fed, a system where the security of people have been enforced, an environment where everyone could live in peace. Without these prerequisites, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi could not invite people to accept any Islamic rules or regulations, because when one is hungry, the last thing on his mind would be him trying to practice religion. I mean, obviously, we don't include everybody, but for the majority of the common people, that is the case. With Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he could not tolerate that he should sit quietly in his house when the poor citizens, the poor Muslims, were being subjected to oppression, either by those who were before him or those who came during his time and after him, especially during the time of Muawiyah, where Muawiyah was being oppressive to people. A brave and a steadfast person like Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam could not let the Muslim fall a prey to the atrocities of the wolves of Bani Umayyah and remain silent and watches everything and remain silent. Of course, this is not the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, that we know. If he had not come to rescue the Muslims at that difficult moment where they needed him the most, he would have been treated as a coward and not the brave and valiant person as he is known through history. Through the actions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he determined and he wrote his name in the books of history. And not just him, that's with everyone else, especially for those who are in a position of power or those who are under those who are oppressors. If we remain silent and accept oppression that falls on us or that falls on our fellow citizen, fellow men, kingsmen, then we are nothing but cowards. But if we fight, if we stand up for our rights, if we speak up, then history will record and writes us as brave heroes. And history, this is what it has been doing since it began, for all those who stood against oppressors are considered to be heroes. And all those who went with the oppressors for the sake of their own desires, for the sake of their own interests, have been looked at as villains and have been looked at as cowardice. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he saw the Muslims in need of a hero, in need of someone to stand up for the right, he rose up to the occasion. And he rose up to this occasion since he was a child, supporting the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam in his mission. Now let us take a short break, then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, and we are still looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam Allah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself said, and he was quoted saying, "I was worried and alarmed lest the foolish and the wicked person should become a ruler of this nation and make the property of God their plaything and the creatures of God their slaves, and fight with the righteous and make the tyrants their helpers." Clearly in the statement, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi is highlighting a very important matter of life, and that is leadership. Those who rule, those who lead, they have two paths in front of them, two roads in front of them. They must take one. Either they decide to be just, fair, and help people and give people their right and establish a utopia for their own people. That's path number one. Or path number two is them becoming tyrants, and they will enslave people, so the people became their slaves, and their wealth and their property becomes their plaything. This is in the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. At the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, each, whether it's him or Banu Umayyah, they stood on different paths. Where Banu Umayyah, they did in fact take the servants of Allah as servants and take the property of people as their plaything or their plaything. And the righteous ones were killed and no one could stand against them. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he himself, he stood on the path of truth. He stood as a thorn in the eyes and in the hands of Banu Umayyah. And Banu Umayyah could not tolerate the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen any longer. Therefore, Muawiyah, he started trying to every possible way to get rid of Amir al-Mu'mineen, be it inciting fitna and sedition from within by bringing the case of Uthman and those who killed Uthman, and then Talha and Zubair had to go to fight Amir al-Mu'mineen in the first battle of Kamu. When that failed, and Amir al-Mu'mineen continued to establish justice, Muawiyah, he himself, took it upon himself to rage war against Amir al-Mu'mineen, be it in Siffin or be it in Nahrawan. And then when that also failed, Muawiyah, obviously, he, the only way in front of him now is to convince those, in a way or another, directly or indirectly, to get rid of Amir al-Mu'mineen altogether. Because Ali alayhi salam was the embodiment of justice. Ali alayhi salam stood for the human rights. He's the one who said, "People are of two kinds, either a brother in faith or equal in humanity." So there was no room in the life of Ali or in the path of Ali for any person to be oppressed, for any person for his right to be taken. And therefore, that was one of the reasons and the main reasons that caused Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam to surrender his soul in the mosque of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the holiest places, in a way where his blood was shed. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala
محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.